I'm not sure what you're used to at this, or I am sure because I've been once, but what I normally do when I'm speaking is define the area in which I work and go with questions, which means that I get challenged by people's asking questions, and if that doesn't work I can fill in. So I'll give you a brief rundown on who I am and then work in. I run the Asylum Seeker Centre, if that's not clear. It's an organisation that I set up on the 6th of February 1997, so I've been doing it 21 years, which means I've been retired for I've been retired for 24 years. So I'll be 77 in June, and I've been doing this work for the last 21 years. So the leaflets are my report, and it's got a lot of information in it because there are no meetings, there's no annual meeting. So each week when I speak, I update the leaflet. That might give you some ideas for questions, or might answer some as well. So I'll backtrack a bit on who I am. I'm married, my wife's here with me, and we've got four married children. We were just talking to Lance yesterday. We had dinner with him at Roses. Thoroughly recommend Roses if you haven't been there before. Lance mentioned that he's 59, which makes him 2 years older than my son. But he said when he was a curate in our parish, he thought my son was a lot younger, which is interesting anyway. So we've been friends for a long time. So my background's Anglican, but the Asylum Seeker Centre is interdenominational or non-denominational. It's not under the Anglican structure, except for the fact that tax deductibility is handled by the diocese. They do it as a favour, which means I don't do the paperwork, which is a bonus. So that's the background. I was talking a bit earlier. I'm Anglo-Indian. I was born in India. I was born in Bangalore. And I came out from India on the Manura. If you remember, the Manura was a coastal trading ship which is outfitted as a troop carrier, went to the war. On the way back, Arthur Colwell said, anyone that wants to nick off from India before it becomes independent, you're quite welcome to jump aboard. On the way out here from India, the press got hold of the fact that the White Australia policy hadn't actually been applied in this case. So they had a whole shipload of people that were coming out that had not been vetted, and that was in the news at the time. So that's my background. We arrived here in 47 on the day of independence of India, and I've lived in Perth. I met my wife there, and we moved from Perth to Melbourne in 1971. So that's my background. I worked 31 years in Telstra. So forget all that. My background is Anglican, that's I've mentioned that. The Asylum Seekers Centre, and I define asylum seekers now and then I'll go with questions. Asylum seekers by definition are onshore applicants for refugee status. So you have to reach Australia to make an application. Whether you come by boat or by plane, you have to reach Australia. You could swim, yeah, and you've got to make an application once you get here. So some people finish up swimming, as you probably know. So that's the definition. You cannot be an asylum seeker. Can't be someone who has gone to another country and queued up and come from there. They're refugees if they get here, and they're analysed by the United Nations to decide their refugee status. The people we see are in two categories. Some fly in, a very few. You'll see the numbers there. The majority, 95% or more, of the people come by boat. So virtually all the people I see have come by boat. And where the government says we stop the boats and overcome that problem and they're all in detention somewhere, in actual fact, a lot of the people in detention have been released into the community and they come into various places. Melbourne, Dandenong is the greatest concentration in Australia. They come there with government papers, so they've satisfied all the requirements in detention. That's not my problem. And they have to live in Greater Dandenong. Do you know Melbourne at all? Dandenong is a suburb and the outer suburbs. Casey is the next... Dandenong and Springvale make up Greater Dandenong, and Casey is the next council. So people have to live in those councils. So only on Thursday someone said, if you're helping asylum seekers, can you help with accommodation? The answer is I can't, because people come to me living in the area of cover. So that clears up my relationship to accommodation. The other issue which I'll hold up so you can see it and then I'll stop for the questions is that people come with identification. A lot of people say they have no identification, they trash their papers, etc., etc. That may or may not be true, I don't think it is. But in actual fact, you see these two coloured things here, they're like a driver's licence. And every asylum seeker that comes by boat, and so probably 98% of them that I see are like that, they have what is called an IMI card, which is the pink one in this case. And when they come, as somebody did the other day, the first thing I say is, do you have the IMI card? You have to be able to prove your immigration status. And invariably, they'll pull out an IMI card. Occasionally, they haven't brought it with them or not for the whole family. And I register on the basis that they'll come back. So every person that comes registers with me, showing me an IMI card or, on very few occasions, an A4 sheet of paper from immigration that says their application is in train. So no one that comes to see me has not got immigration papers. So the difference between those people who are looking to be refugees, if and when the government decides, and people who come through refugee camps, is that the people from refugee camps come in as government-sponsored refugees and have full entitlement to Australian support when they get here. Asylum seekers, and I haven't mentioned this, the ones on the pink IMI card are on 87% of the new start allowance. You'll see it on the leaflet. It's just under $500, and it immediately dispels the rumour that they get a lot more than pensioners. Pensioners, if I remember rightly, get something over $800 equivalent. So you can Google that and find it out in 30 seconds. So that's true, but you can check it if you want. Okay, so refugees come from overseas, Sudan used to be placement, and come here sponsored and settle into the community. Asylum seekers, for the last 7 years, have been told they will not be given permanency if they come by boat. So we've got a nucleus of about, I think it's up to 440 again now. It's around 430, 450. And they come in once a week for food, and then they get other stuff as well from a free op shop. If they miss four consecutive weeks, they're off, and they never get back on again. So people say, why do you have such a harsh rule? It's emergency food. If you go 4 weeks without emergency food, I'm doubtful there's an emergency. Occasionally someone's got a real reason, and I will put them on. Okay, I'll stop there and go with questions, and you can ask any questions. Yes, it's called, they call it an IMI card. It's an immigration identification card. In fact, if you see this form that's been put out by immigration, the heading is IMI cards. So it's a nickname for their identification card. Want to go with any questions at all, clarification, and you can ask about my background or the things that I do, whatever you like. Otherwise, I'll keep talking, and that'll bore you. Where do most come from is the question. On the sheet, you'll see that I identify Rohingya Muslim people. 31%, if I've got it remembered. It's about 30%. 32%. 80% of the people I see are Muslim. That's one issue there, grouping. And of the total, 32%, one out of three, are Rohingya Muslim people. So that's the old Burma. They come from Rakhine State, which is the state that borders Bangladesh. And you see all the publicity. They're very peaceful people. Two of them wear full hijab, which is their eyes showing, and in the street. If I see them, they wave and jump up and down, the kids wave and run over to me. When they get into the centre, they take the covering off, which I find rather interesting. In the street, invariably, right up to the time they come in, they've got their face covered, but they take it off in the centre. Sorry, I interrupted. Yeah, this is a question of the long-term future for these people. I said 7 years, some of them, I've seen some of them for 7 years. All we can do is give them an environment where they can feel sort of at peace and not threatened. But behind that is a question of what is going to happen to me. Not only to me, but my family, who the rest of my family, and they're quite often separated from them, and they get very depressed, or they can get very depressed, I should say. And what we try to do is give them an environment in which we treat them without differentiation, and in the course of that, we're able to demonstrate what our, or my understanding of Christian love is. And I have people who are not Christians helping me, Muslim people as well. So we're trying to demonstrate that this is a microcosm of society. We can get on with one another, be different, and still communicate Christ's love to people in what we do. And while you'll see on the leaflet, it's Matthew 25:35, you know that one. And that's the basis. And the other one's Matthew 5:16. Let your light so shine. The way we do that is I have a sign which is up all the time, and if I remember rightly, it says new NIV Bibles, Jesus DVDs are available. If you want them, see me. So that's the hard sell. They see the sign and they ask for a Bible, or they ask for a DVD. This is Luke's Gospel, Jesus DVD, Luke's Gospel acted out in English. Unfortunately, this guy doesn't look very much like Jesus, but that's another thing. And it's actually dubbed in this one in 32 languages. So when people ask for it, the intention is that they get it and they hear the gospel in their own language, which I don't speak. And that opens up discussions. So that's part of what we're trying to do, is to demonstrate the basis for what we do in a church. I'm just talking to someone whose name I've forgotten. He's from Ghana. Richard, we're talking to you. The Nigeria, you mentioned Nigeria. The Redeemed Christian Church of God is a Nigerian denomination based in Lagos. The church that I'm operating in Dandenong is the Redeemed Christian Church of God. It's called Jesus House for All Nations. And along with all the other locations we've had, it's been provided at no charge. So I have no overheads, and we do it voluntarily. No overheads in terms of what we do. So there's no pressure on me to raise funds, because it's a ministry of faith. I've said to someone, I'm a steward of God's provision. It's a pretty simple model. God provides it, I manage it. He's given me gifts of management, I manage it. I don't have to ask for more. We'll never run out, because God's going to provide what we need, not what we want. And that's worked for 21 years. So coming back to the people we see, some do get depressed, and I'll give you an example. One well-dressed Afghan Muslim guy comes in on his own every time. Now, he came 3 times last week. I've seen him in the plaza sitting on his own. Now, I took him aside a week ago and I said, look, I've noticed you come on your own. Why don't you come and help us, and then we can talk in English? He said, my English is not good. I said, that's the whole point, mate, that I come in and we're not a threat. Come in and you can talk to us in English. That'll help you. And he went out on Thursday when I spoke to him again. He went out smiling. You can see a difference between people in their demeanour when they're depressed. I mean, I don't have to tell you this, you can tell. And then when you give them some sort of ray of hope, you can see a change in their attitude. And that's part of what we're trying to do. Yeah, the question of where the stuff comes from, because you see, we've given away an excess of $6 million in material aid. That values everything, of which $2 million has been food. The food we get from two sources. One comes from churches that support directly what we do, or individuals, and one comes from cash which people give me. And I buy from Food Bank, which is a Victorian organisation in this case. I buy about $250 worth a week. Now that's a full BMW station wagon full. The guy that picks it up drives a BMW station wagon. He runs a business with 130 people. And Tuesdays he tells him he can't be sent interstate in his own business. Don't send me interstate on Monday, not available. Why? Because Tuesday morning, he says, is his service. And he comes in every Tuesday morning, helps unpack, goes and gets the food, we unpack it, and then he goes on and does his other business. He and his wife run a business where they set up the displays and stuff in Bunnings stores. That's the work. There's 130 employees. And next week he's in New Zealand looking at stores. and he's quite often up around this area in New South Wales doing. So that's his service. And that's what people do. They give up time for whatever reason and just come and help. So food comes half from churches. Some of them bring it straight to Dandenong, and some bring it straight to my place. So when I get back, there'll be stuff in my... We've got two unregistered cars. They just put it in there and then I take it. So Mount Martha Uniting Church, just to link in, and Mount Martha IGA, which is a link through the church. They have a wire basket outside the store, and people buy two and put one in the basket. Every week, Mount Martha brings a carload of stuff. That's from the IGA, and the IGA puts in to run stuff in there as well. So there's a whole range of things like that. And any other questions? Yep, go again.
So you can definitely pressure them
There's a question whether they're allowed to work. I hold up that pink card, which is a no-work bridging visa, the pink IMI card. They're now being given the ability to work on either 3 or 5 year temporary protection. That's the current stage that's being rolled out. The example then is that if you're given a 5 year visa, you have to go to the country. And the country doesn't mean, I don't know if it means Cooma, but it's more likely to mean some outlying part of Cooma rather than Cooma. Certainly in Ballarat it does. And if you have a 3 year visa, the same. You can't live right in the middle of towns or anything. They want you to go out into the outskirts. So they give you a list of postcodes out of which you can choose where to work on these visas. So it's, they're able to get work. I'm sorry. They're allowed to get work, but the problem immediately arises as soon as you prove your status. You're proving your status with a card that says that you're not permanent and you don't know what's going to happen. On the way through here to here, and I did it last time as well, I called into Boomers, which is in I've forgotten the name of the place now. It's out of Bairnsdale anyway, Lindenau, the market garden area. And I called into Andrew Boomer. I think it's the fourth time I've called in. He's not been, he's on annual leave this time. And I said, well, I'm striking out here. I said, but there's someone that works here. And I mentioned, they said, no, he's stopped working here. He's quite welcome to come back, but he's stopped to his own decision. So I didn't know that because I saw Helen, his wife, on Thursday. And she didn't mention it. But obviously travelling from Melbourne to Bairnsdale and coming back on the weekends is quite stressful and costly. But it's interesting, she said he is quite welcome to come back. He's left of his own accord. This is Mortiza. Their son, Helen and Mortiza, he was 16 years old. He drove without a licence under the influence. He was taken in by immigration in Melbourne, put into immigration detention, moved to Darwin, moved from Darwin to Perth, and as of now, he's in detention in Perth, has been for 5 years for breaking the law. I've seen him in detention. In the detention centre, where he's located, it's actually the caravan park opposite Perth Airport. Central Avenue is a road opposite Perth Airport, Central Caravan Park, cabin, Mahan in the cabin. And make sure he doesn't escape. Two Serco guards, 24 hours a day on shifts. Two of them in pairs, I'm talking about. Two at a time, 12-hour shift, another 12-hour shift. He goes to the Baptist Church in South Perth. So what do you need to go to Baptist Church? You need transport. Who provides transport? A third Serco guard. So he's responsible for having three Serco guards go to church every Sunday. seriously, that's it. And these guys said, we don't know why he's in detention. And the other people said, we're really glad he's in detention. It keeps us employed. And that's their comments. I've spoken to them. And I visited him in detention, in the cabin. He was married in detention by the Baptist pastor in Dandenong, flew over there with his mum. They were allowed him to be married and then said, now you can nick off. They didn't give them any time, basically. So he's been married. He's got a child. He's now a year old, and last November, the Baptist Church in South Perth paid for Mortiza and Helen to fly to visit their grandson for the first time. And I went to the church and there was a big celebration. So it's very easy to say that, but you think about all that ramifications.
What's
Serco? Serco is a company that provides the service for the security guards. So if you go to Perth Airport, which I had to in the first place, there's a whole heap of Serco guards there because that is a proper detention centre where people are taken off the plane and kept in detention. And to see a person like Mahan, I had to fill out online papers, and it took quite a while, and eventually, and I was running out of time when this happened, eventually they said, yes, you can now apply to immigration, and they'll have to say yes. And I'd run out of time by then. I was in Perth for a week at that time. So what happened, I found out he was going to church. So I was speaking at Mount Pleasant, and I said, well, when I've spoken, I'm going to nick off. It's not because I don't like you, love you a lot, but I'm going to go. And I went straight round to the Baptist church, got there before the service had ended. So the Serco guards saw me in the church. And when I went to the detention centre, they said, well, you know, what are you doing? And I said, I've come to see Ghazala. She's not in detention. And they said, oh, you're from the church. That's okay. Back inside again. So they saw me at church, and that was enough for me to get into detention. Whereas I'd spent days trying to get through on the internet. So, I mean, it's a really unwieldy system. And he has to be in detention. If you want to think about it, pray about it. His mum said on Thursday she's hoping for good news about his case. And I said, and I'm doing it now, I'll ask people to pray for Mahan and Ghazala. And 5 years is a long time. Mm-hmm. If it had been your kid, he would have been given a kick in the backside or something, and then he'd be out on the streets in no time. 5 years in detention. At a ridiculous cost, in my view. So that's Serco guards. The other situation about guards is on Manus and on Nauru. One of the guys who was there on Thursday has just finished a 5-year placement on Nauru, on Manus, which he did for 2 years, and then Nauru. They've just changed their contract again, the government. So the people who are looking after that aren't the people who are looking after it recently. Before that, the Salvation Army had the contract. There's people from Salvation Army here. They lost the contract to Transfield, and Transfield have lost the contract to someone else. So each time this happens, the service goes down. They don't take on a new contractor because they're charging more. That's just a definition of government policy. So this guy, Jibri, speaks 6 languages, he's a Muslim guy. He's worked on Manus and Nauru. He was telling someone the other day that he'd invited me to his daughter's reception, which he did, and I know this, but he said David and Yvonne were our invited guests. Because when I got there, Yvonne was the only woman sitting where I was. He said, you're guests. We were the only non-Muslim people. We were the only ones that weren't Sri Lankan, basically, and we were the only ones given cutlery, and she was the only woman sitting with the men. We were offered food first. And he brought it up the other day, you were our guest. Which is really interesting because I appreciate that sort of relationship with people. He's Muslim, he comes to the centre regularly, he came on Thursday and helps, and with his ability, language ability, it's very, very handy. Yep. Anyone can support what we do. I think that's your question. I don't define what we do to exclude anyone. The fact is we don't get support from the Muslim community.
No, they don't do it.
The nearest that they've got is in Dubton, where there's a mosque. I think it was a year ago at Ramadan. They rang me one day and said, can you publicise the fact if people come tomorrow, we'll give them food at the mosque. So I said, send me something by email. They actually sent me 2 emails changing the time. The first one and then the second had a different time. I put out quarter 4 notices and handed them out. to everyone that came in that was Muslim. And they contacted me and said that they knew it had happened because people came in with these little slips. And that was a one-off thing. And I said to the guy, we do this every week. So why don't you come out and have a chat to us and see what we do and let's work together. He said yes, but I've never seen him. So I'm making objective statements. I'm not implying criticism here, but it's a fact. People could come to us without differentiation, but the support we've had from the Muslim community is virtually nil, and they don't get support.
No,
I haven't heard
that at all.
No. Yeah. And I'll take it a stage further, and I'm not wanting to be offensive, it's a fact again. I had a Muslim student working with me, and she said, will you help people at Ramadan? Because it was coming up to Ramadan. I said, yes. And I said, well, go and see the council and see if you can hire the barbecue area, and then something, something. Anyway, she went out and went straight to the Muslim butcher and asked him if she could get meat. Then she went to the Muslim mosque in South Dandenong and asked them if they'd support it. And she disappeared for the day. And I said, the next day, I said, look, I'm responsible for you. You're on contract for me to supervise. You can't just disappear like that. She said, oh, well, I was doing this and that. And I said, okay, well, you can't do that. I need to know where you are. When she went to the South Dandenong Mosque, the guy said, yes, we were quite happy to help you. And then that went on for quite a while, and it was all right. And then as she was leaving, he said, oh, by the way, they are all Sunni, are they? And she said, no, they're not all Sunni. And he said, no, the Shia can't come. Only the Sunni. Now, this I told her that before she went out in briefing her. I said, in the Preston Mosque where she went, she was told the same. I said, it's not true. Now, you'll find out for yourself, it is not true. And if a Sunni goes into a Shia mosque, if a Shia goes into a Sunni mosque, unless they play act, they know there's a difference. And they don't make them welcome. And that came out there. So there's this tension between the different parts of Islam. And the two mosques in Dandenong are both Sunni, and the Shia don't go there. And the Shia are Afghan Hazaras are Shia. So is that what I'm saying makes sense, as I'm using a bit of terminology? It's not that I don't want to go. I've been to the twice I've made contact to the Islamic school and asked if I can speak there. Once I spoke directly to the principal face to face, but I've not been able to get in. Just to talk about what we do. In the people that we see, we can tell who are Muslim mainly, and then it comes to the crunch when we offer them ham. You know what I mean. We're giving away ham at Christmas, and people won't take ham. And by then, we mostly know who they are. But that's a sort of that's a way that we can tell whether people are Muslim or not, whether we're guessing. So that's one thing. And the same with meat. We used to get it from Bairnsdale, from the Baptist. They'd butcher a couple of lambs and bring them. It's not halal. So we'd say the meat is not halal, and they wouldn't take it. So all the Christians thought it was really good. And it was lamb. And the Hindus thought it was really good as well. And then the next time they'd bring beef, and they'd say, this is not halal, and it's beef. And all the Hindus wouldn't touch it, so the Christians thought that was really good. No. But that's just the reality of it. I mean, we're given it, and we put into a freezer and we let people know. So that's we do have Hindu people, we do have Buddhist people. Yep. I think we need a different policy in terms of dealing with people who are already here. I think it's really inhumane to just hold them in limbo as a way of stopping other people from coming by boat. That's the first thing. I mean, people have been in this limbo a long time, and they're not a lot. It's not a huge number of them. That's one thing. The actual stopping the boats, I think we have to control our borders. We can't just have everyone fly in and swim in and come by boat and just say we're here, you have to take us. There has to be management. I don't have a problem with management, but I think what we're doing is very harsh on a particular group of people and has been for a long time. So when I speak to politicians, I don't talk politics. And I speak to quite a few of them. I said, you guys are politicians, you're elected to make policies. That's your job. My job is to deal with the people affected by your policies. So I'm here to tell you how your policies affect people in the hope that you'll change your policies. So Greg Hunt is an example. I've spoken to a couple of times, and he's sort of a national politician in that sense. So it doesn't matter which side of politics they come from, I have the same approach. I don't have a political view that I express. I have a humanitarian or Christian view, if you want to put it that way. So that's my sort of ballpark statement. I don't want to... And when I've gone to see Greg Hunt, people that live in his electorate, he's a waste of time, he's hopeless, he's this and that. No good talking to him. And I say, how do you know? You ever talked to him? Now, they've decided what he is, and then they won't talk to him. I go and talk to him in the hope that he'll change. You know? And that I don't know whether he's going to change or not, but at least at the end we're still talking. Otherwise you just polarise it.
Yep.
Below me?
Below you.
None.
Who's
the director? I handle the finance. Yeah. Sorry. I keep all the financial records, and the tax deductibility is done through the diocese, so I'm accountable to the diocese for what they put through for taxation purposes. And all the information there is the records that I keep. Yeah. So this is completely voluntary, so there's no overhead from my point of view. We fund our own travel and accommodation to make it easy for people. And the bulk, you'll see the amount of money I've got is about 800,000. The overheads are listed there in the sheet, but there's about 40,000. That I classify as overheads, which has got to do with postage stamps and paying for a post office box and stuff. So there is no committee. It makes it very simple. You'll probably understand that without my explaining. But if I get swamped, and a few years ago we went up to 440 very quickly at the end of the year, and I went home to Vaughan and I said, look, 440, we can't handle this increase, and we didn't have the support. So I said, I'm going to have to do something. And the next week, all the people that have been coming for some time, there were 60 of them, I gave them each a $50 voucher and kissed them goodbye in my terms. They all knew that, you know, we had 60 for a while, suddenly it gets to 440. They knew that we were being swamped. So when I said we can't keep supporting you, they accepted that. All the people were on the books, I said geographically limited it further and said they could only come for 6 months. Then we took them off. So by managing the geographic boundaries and the time, we cut the numbers down. And then as we've been able to gain more support, we've been able to take the numbers up to 440 again. I think it's exactly 440. Yeah, it's exactly 440 now. And we can accommodate them as long as there's no time limit on it.
When you drop them off, what options do they have?
There's no other options. Because I'm the only one doing it, and it's geographically limited as well. If you live in Monash, where I live, I don't register people in Monash. There's no one else doing regular food. That's just a fact. So while I feel sorry for them, we've got the whole of the metropolitan area. And sometimes people come from Sunshine, Sunbury, Broadmeadows, and we give them food once and say, I'm sorry, we can't register, we've come this far, we'll give you food, that's it. We can give them computers and the op shop stuff. It's food is the limitation. So when they were dropped off after 6 months, they're on their own, but now we can do it indefinitely. So that's because there's less people sort of turning up. We had a family come from Sydney just last week. They had their papers, they'd moved down from Sydney. So we're still getting people moving interstate. There's one behind you.
Is there any problem as far as the government, if they treated these people exactly the same as they treated the Greek Jews back in the 50s, where they came out, they had to live in camps, but they also had to work for 2 years. You see any problem with these people being absorbed under those sort of rules?
Putting it the way you're saying, no, I don't. But broadening the whole issue, we've got a far bigger refugee problem. Now, worldwide, we've got a huge refugee problem. So this is only the pinhead of a big problem. Given an opportunity, these people would work. I was talking just earlier today, do you love a duck? Do you know the prepared duck product they have in the supermarket? That's manufactured in Newell, and that's staffed basically by Karen and Chin refugees. Karen are generally Anglican, Chin are generally Baptist, not quite as clear, but and they've moved there as a block, and we have several Chin and Burmese Anglican ordained ministers, as do the Baptist. So that's what they've done, they've moved there. And there's other sort of examples of that happening. So people, in fact, to go back a stage, about 15 years ago, people walked out of Chin state, walked into India, came out on false passports to a Baptist Congress and applied, international thing, and applied for refugee status. The guy that led them was a Baptist pastor, and I've been to his church where he has a congregation of over 400. So they're not all Muslim, you know, sort of, you've got Christian people as well as others coming out. And they, all those people, when they were given permanency, they had jobs all over the place. They worked in Pilkington's, in the glass for cars as it was then. They worked picking fruit, vegetable gardens. They just got jobs straight away. So some people are motivated to do it. Not everyone, I'd have to say. But the majority would be keen. I'll give you 3 examples, and you're the keeper of the time. Three examples. One of them came in last Thursday, actually, but before that, a few weeks ago, 3 of them came in within a few days. These are all Afghan, Shia, Hazara, Muslim guys. All of them helped me. All of them now work. One of them runs a car wrecking business, and I said, I don't want to hold you up too long. You probably need to get back. And he said, no, it's all right. I said, how's it all right? He said, I've got 5 people working for me, and that's in about a year. Another guy bought a light AC utility and has upgraded to a truck. He's married, he's bought a house, and he came in to see me within days. The 3 of them worked together at the centre. And then Jawed came in the other day. He's working as a tiler in big factory buildings. So there's a group of them, they travel around, share the expenses. And as he said, I've got a proper job. I said, what's a proper job, Jawed? He said, I've got a tax file number. And that's something he's saying there. You know, these guys get jobs and people pay them, you know, cash, no super, no tax, and he's got a proper job. He's working for a firm, they take out super, they take out tax, he's got a tax file number. And he just comes in to say g'day. No, that's under that condition. Yeah, the guy that runs the car business is based in Hastings, which is on outlying, it's not a part of Melbourne as such, but it's further up. So he's, yeah. So when he came and showed me his papers, he said, can you help me with this? I can go and work in any of these postcodes. If you're a normal person, you're given sheets of postcodes, you think it's a bit daunting. But these people don't speak English as a first language. Quite often don't speak English really well, and you know, in some situations he does. He's got an economics degree, actually. It's our way of telling them it's going to be hard. Here's a list, find one, you know, and then go and live there as well. Yeah, we have a lot of Sudanese in Dandenong, And that's a different, and there's a different issue there. So they've moved around all over the place. And on Thursday, I actually met, last Thursday, I went over to the Catholic Church and I met a permanent deacon. I didn't know they had such a thing. They got a permanent deacon. He's married. He's 6'8" tall. He stopped growing, thankfully. He's 6'8" tall and he speaks perfect English, and he's been ordained as a permanent deacon in the Catholic Church. And he said there are 17 of them. I didn't even know the category existed. And so the Catholic Church is moving with the new regime, permanent deacons for a particular task. And that's a guy I met. The Catholic priest there, I left a note for him, he wasn't there, he rang me the same afternoon. I'm having a coffee with him on Friday, on Wednesday. I said, let's just have a chat, because we can work together. Whereas the predecessor of this guy, the deacon, when I went there, his immediate reaction is, why are you here? What are you doing? You know, it's like, this is my bailiwick. And I thought, he had no intention of working with me. Whereas the new guy, George, is saying, yeah, come on down. No, you want to talk in the church? I've got a group of 400. We'll have to come and talk to them. A different mental attitude to the same problem. So I think all around Melbourne, there are different examples of Sudanese moving out in different languages. This is Arabic in Dandenong. And the other groups you're talking about, the Afghans tend to live around Dandenong, and they've moved a bit further out. They've got a very high proportion of people in one primary school just out of Dandenong. So they haven't moved out the same way as the Sudanese. I'm just using them as examples. I'm not a... I think they're two distinct things, to be clear on that. The government wanting people to move out is a bit similar to post-war. You know, we sent people where we thought Australians didn't want to go, in my terms, and that's still the case. So they're trying to get people to move out. My experience in the country places where I've been and spoken is they're very welcoming to people come in. They'll lean over to make them welcome. So I don't think there's a real tension in moving, unless it's a new thing and you're not happy to face it. But once you get there, and most of the experience I've had is people are really keen. They want people to come and they're willing to bridge the gaps, and there's a whole range of things. With the Sudanese, there's a lot of bad publicity about the Sudanese, and it's not necessarily so, to put it simply. I mean, in this Nigerian church I was talking about earlier, they run a children's program for the whole holiday period. So I went in when they had about 40 people there, several adults and lots of kids. And I went in and I said to the pastor's wife, I said, I'm going to have to go and find security. And she said, why? I said, I've just seen an African gang. And she thought I was serious. And I said, no, I'm joking, but there's all these people here. They're all African. That could be an African gang, except it's not. So I went to the papers and I said, why don't you print a good news story? Here's a church running a program, keeping the kids off the street. You can come and take photos. They're all happy. Didn't get an answer from the three papers. Didn't get an answer. They prefer, and I'm interpreting this, they prefer to write bad news. And in the past I had contact with three journalists who I could ring and they would do the right thing. Now you go through a phone system, so you're not talking to a person unless someone at the other end decides. So they didn't pick it up. Which I think is a real, really sad, because there's a counter argument to what's going on. In Dandenong, if I can just, am I finishing on something? You tell me, ring a bell or something. In Dandenong, I've got the Nigerian church, I'm in it, that's one thing. Across the road from me in the arcade is a daycare centre that's owned and run by Christian Sudanese. And there's one Muslim girl that works there, the rest are Christian Sudanese. If I go down further, there's another daycare centre, It's got two Kenyan Muslim ladies in it. I went in and I tried to start a conversation. They never said a word. Eventually I said, somebody in here must know something about refugees. And they said, we're not refugees, we're not refugees, we're skilled migrants from Kenya. I said, yeah, skilled migrants from Kenya that pretended you couldn't understand English till just then. So now I'm on good terms with them. They were just sitting there mute. But now that's them. Further down we've got a Sri Lankan travel agent, all Sri Lankans, Christian guys. So it's a very mixed culture there. I don't have to go very far to get translation. One day a lady came in when I was in the church itself, and I could hear her getting an answer no, and I said, what was the question? And they said, oh, she wanted someone to translate something in Swahili. So I was only a few yards away from her by then. So I said, hang on a sec, I'll help you. We went down to the hairdressing salon where the ladies had their heads in those bucket things, and I stuck my head in the door. I said, this lady wants someone that can speak Swahili. Yes, says one lady. Problem solved. I mean, seriously. You're saying no here and not to, but 40 yards down there's a hairdressing salon with a solution. So this is a church responding, but it could be anyone. If you want to help people, you can help them. If you say, well, it's not my job, you can shut it down. So I just I've said in here in the leaflet, you'll see we've given out 1,100 copies of this. So people hear the gospel in their own language, and I'll put a time on this and you can say no. Next week I'm speaking at Pakenham Uniting Church. The following week it's Hampton Park Baptist. They had a fly-in family who have been baptised from Iran, Arabic speaking people, and they've got another family being prepared for baptism who have been to see me. So both those families come to see me and their kids come to see me as well. So Hampton Park Baptist, I had the opportunity when these people said, who can I go to? I could have sent them to the Uniting Church, the Anglican Church, Cranbourne Uniting Church, Cranbourne Anglican, Anglican Church in Hampton Park. And I chose to send them to a Baptist church, and I've been challenged on this, but that was the best fit for them. If you understand young family, mixed culture, you know, motivated to do it, age, that was the best fit for them. They've baptised a number of people, and it's a continuing process for them to be dealing with Iranians. Whereas the other churches are good churches, I've spoken there, but to get a new family and start with a new culture and language is not helpful to the family. That's my view. That's why I chose it. But I'll just say something which I haven't said, and that is that reading between the lines in what I've got in the leaflet and my speaking engagements, I speak 50-50 in church and community. I've done 1,000 sermons, which was last year, and I've just done 1,000 community. So the objective is to try and get a Christian viewpoint into Rotary and Progress and stuff like that. And you can do it. I've found you can do it. And the way you do it is to say, if I was in a church in a sermon, I'd say this. And no one's ever queried me because you're phrasing it like that. That's what I would say, and I do say in a church in a sermon. You can make the statement in other and get into secular organisations and get a Christian viewpoint across, which I think is where we're sort of falling down on the job in a way as church. We're good in church in church, but society is sort of looking from outside in, and I think we've got the opportunity of being outside.